Hi, I'm Tony Rossi for The Christophers, and today we'll be discussing one of World War II's most compelling stories of courage. Author Talar J. Mazzeo will join me to talk about her in-depth biography, Irena's Children, which tells the story of Irena Sendler, who saved 2,500 children from the Warsaw Ghetto. Stay with us. Christopher Close-Up starts right now. Hello and welcome to Christopher Close-Up. I'm Tony Rossi. A lot of people are familiar with the story of German industrialist Oskar Schindler, who saved 1,200 Jewish lives during the Holocaust by employing them in his factories. What you may not know is that there is a woman known as the female Oskar Schindler. Her name is Irena Sendler, and she was a social worker in Nazi-occupied Poland whose efforts as part of the Polish resistance saved the lives of 2,500 Jewish children from the Warsaw Ghetto. Irena and a network of others, some of whom were motivated by their Catholic faith, faced danger with every step and even endured torture. Now, author Talar J. Mazzeo is telling their story in an in-depth biography called Irena's Children. To tell us more, I am pleased to welcome to Christopher Close-Up, Talar J. Mazzeo. Talar, thanks so much for being on the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
Sure. Now, let me start with the very basic question. Is what first got you interested in the story of Irena Sendler?
So what I write on is women's biography. That's what I do for a living, interested in stories about amazing women. And my brother and sister-in-law worked for the State Department over in Poland, and I had gone to visit my brand new niece and nephew over there. And that visit coincided with the period where Irena Sendler, who's very, very well known in Poland, had just died. So it was my sister-in-law who turned me on to the story of really an amazing group of women.
Sure. Well, tell us a little bit about pre-World War II Irena Sendler, because, you know, based on what you write in your book, she was an incredibly strong-willed woman when society didn't necessarily accept women or want women as strong-willed.
Yeah, she was very, very strong-willed and had a very clear moral compass, I think, early on in her childhood. So her dad was a physician and was very involved with social work. And he was one of the few doctors at that time who was willing to treat poor patients, but especially poor Jewish patients. Mm-hmm. And she grew up watching him engage in that kind of work about social justice. And he died when she was very young from a disease that he caught treating impoverished patients. Mm-hmm. So that was a really profound impression on her as a young woman. She went on to go to the university in Warsaw. She originally wanted to be an attorney and for a time was very involved with helping people who were also impoverished fight against predatory landlords. That's something she was very interested in. Mm-hmm. But in that period of time, women were not supported as being attorneys in Poland. So instead, she became a teacher and ultimately a social worker and did graduate-level work in social work.
Right.
So
right.
That by the time the Second World War started, she was a very experienced social worker.
Sure. Well, let me touch on the part you said about her dad helping Jewish people in Poland. How were the Jewish people in Poland at the time seen by their contemporaries, most of whom were Catholic? Did they get along, or was anti-Semitism a problem?
There definitely was anti-Semitism in Poland, as there was across Europe. And it wasn't everybody, of course. It really depended on people's experiences with the community. But generally, there was a particular political faction that became more prominent in the 1930s, the same time, of course, that it also became more prominent in Germany in the 1930s, that was particularly anti-Semitic. So there were a series of riots across Poland in the 1930s about wanting to disenfranchise the Jewish community from certain kinds of civil rights.
Right, right. I'm talking to Talar J. Mazzeo about her book, Irena's Children, A True Story of Courage. Tell me a little bit about Dr. Helena Rudlinska, who shaped the person Irena became and also, I think, planted seeds of the life-saving work she and others would do during the war.
Yeah, so Helena Rudlinska is, I think, actually key to Irena Sendler's story, to the work that she and a group of women did. That was one of the probably the most important thing that I discovered in the process of doing this research, was just really how important Helena Rudlinska was. So she was a professor. She came from a Jewish family background, but she'd actually converted to Catholicism. So she was one of those people in one of those that very difficult situation of people who thought of themselves as Catholic, but came from a Jewish cultural background. And so under the laws of ultimately the German occupation would have been considered Jewish. And she was a professor at the Polish Free University, which was a very progressive university that was trailblazing in social work. In fact, Helena Rudlinska was probably the person who was most important in establishing what we now think of as the sort of welfare safety net. Mm-hmm. In the European and North American context.
Okay.
And she drew around her a group of very talented students, many of whom were women, because women were drawn to social work for of different cultural reasons. And that means that by the time the war began, there was this group of young women who all had a lot of experience organizing, community organizing, and very, very close connections with each other and with Rudlinska.
Right, right. I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close Up. I'm talking to Tilar J. Mazzeo about her book, Irena's Children, A True Story of Courage. Now, this is a Catholic radio show, so, and I know that Irena Sendler is kind of seen in the Catholic world as a very devout person. But really what I discovered in reading your book is that at this point in her life, she was not that person yet. I think she became it, as you write, after the war, years later, a more devout Catholic. But tell us a little bit about Irena and her personal beliefs at the time.
Yeah, so as a teenager, she did grow up Catholic. Almost all of the women that she worked with on what was then called the Aryan side were Catholic. They also did work with friends in the Jewish community. But so she grew up Catholic. She was, I think, as a teenager, quite devout. But by the time she became a 20-year-old, she became a bit of a lapsed Catholic. I think it would be fair to say.
Okay.
She was married, and she that marriage was not working out in her early 20s particularly well. So she had fallen in love with a Jewish man who was also married, who became her boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this very bohemian kind of period that she went through in her 20s and into her 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Later on in her life, after the war, she, especially following the death of one of her children, she does return to the Catholic faith very, very profoundly. But
right.
For the period that this book is about, she has a loose relationship with Catholicism,
I think
we could say.
Well, no, I think it's great that you point this out, because sometimes we can sanitize images of the saints and overlook the fact that they lived colorful, complex lives, so to speak. And while Irena isn't a saint, there are those parts of her life that are kind of overlooked because of the great good she did. Why do you think it's important to look at the whole picture and all aspects of Irena Sendler to get a truer picture of what she accomplished?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it takes anything away from her story that she struggled with all those kinds of human temptations that everybody, I mean, you know, different ways we all struggle with temptations and, you know, with our moral compass.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it takes anything away from her story that that on the one hand, she had this intense sense of righteousness and moral courage, and she risked her life over and over again to do the thing that was right and ethical for the children of other people, right? But to understand that she made that decision in the context of being an average and flawed person like all of us,
mm-hmm.
I think actually makes that story more powerful and more inspiring. So it's certainly not meant, you know, our talking about it, I think, is not meant in any way to take away from, but really to enhance the story of what just average people can do if we listen to our moral compass.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you. And so I'm glad that you know, you cover all this in the book and you flesh it out, because it's like I said, it's too easy to sanitize people. We need to look at the complex parts of human nature, because that's inside all of us. And I thought you did a beautiful job capturing that in the book. I'm talking to Tilar J. Mazzeo about her book, Irena's Children. Let me just go back to the war part again. So how did life change for both Jews and Christians when the Nazis invaded?
Yeah, so what happened was, because the Germans, of course, had the idea that Jewish people were subhuman, but they also had the idea that the Slavic race, as they called it, was also subhuman. So when the Germans took over, they immediately classified all of the residents of Poland, whether they were of German descent, in which case they were in one category, or whether they were of Semitic descent or Slavic descent. And in the beginning, in fact, the kind of brutality was really focused much more on the Polish population, on making sure that there was no Polish national resistance, and on, you know, destroying the ability of that society to function in a way that would allow for there to be a resistance to German rule. But as the war went on, the problem became, from the German perspective, what to do with this large Polish and Polish Jewish population, especially in Warsaw, but also in the other cities. And there originally was the idea that they were going to deport them, but in order and before they knew where they were going to deport them, they put them in the ghetto, right? So the Jews were forced to build the ghetto and then forced to live in the ghetto. And they were given in their ration cards a much lower caloric intake. So if you were Jewish, you were expected to live on under 200 calories a day. If you were Polish, you were given about 800 calories a day. And so what happens is that they're in this very crowded area in the city. There's no food. The medicine is not going to the Jewish community. And at that point, epidemics begin in the ghetto. And it's in part when the epidemics begin, especially of cholera and typhoid, that the Germans become very concerned about the contamination of the Jewish population at that moment. And so things from there really escalate quite terribly. And then they ultimately end, of course, with the deportations to the death camps like Treblinka.
Sure. Well, when how did Arena get involved in helping the Jewish people first and then starting to smuggle their children into Gentile families?
Yeah. So for Arena, she's working in the social office, right, the social welfare office still. That's her job. She's had Polish and Jewish clients. When the Germans take over, there's a decree that says no Jewish person can receive any social welfare. So she and her girlfriends in the social welfare office see that they're going to resist the Germans, right? For them, they're Poles. They're going to resist against the German occupation. And what they, in the beginning, just decide to do is to keep giving money to all of their social welfare clients. And if they're Jewish, they invent files. They make up fake files and they commit fraud and in order to deceive and resist against the Germans, and they give that money.
Yeah.
But then what happens is that when all Jews are ordered into the ghetto, her boyfriend ends up also inside the ghetto. And Arena quite quickly manages to arrange for a doctor to give her an epidemic control pass so that she can be one of the social workers in who's able to go in and out of the ghetto, which puts her in a very rare situation, right? Yeah. So she goes, she's able to see her boyfriend every day now. And when she's in there, and as starvation and disease takes hold in the ghetto, that means that she's a firsthand witness to the fact that there are lots of orphaned children, right? Their parents have died from hunger or starvation or have been shot. And so these children are living on the street and starving to death. She describes how in order to go and see Adam, her boyfriend, she had to walk over the bodies of children. And so she pleads with Adam to let to escape the ghetto. And she says, I'll help you escape, right? We can be together. But Adam's wife and his family are also in the ghetto. And Adam says he can't leave. So I think what happens is that she and Adam then decide that if she can't get Adam out, that she and Adam will work together to get these orphaned children out. So it begins with street children who have no parents. She ends up taking them out of the ghetto, different, very creative ways of smuggling them out of the ghetto, and places them with either Catholic orphanages. Some of the convents in particular have orphanages, and they take in those children, or with foster families who are Polish.
Right.
So she reaches out to people in her network and says, will you take these kids? The amazing thing that she says is nobody ever said no to her, although it meant risking their own lives and the lives of their own children to do that.
Right, right. Well, yeah, no, I was definitely impressed by that, too, because whatever, you know, anti-Semitism we were talking about earlier existed, people, you know, put that aside just to save that common bond of humanity. And you know, I think that's one of the beautiful parts of the story.
think a lot of people felt that their responsibility as Christians was, I mean, I think for many of them, that was an act of faith, what they believed that they were doing very explicitly. That was a responsibility.
I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up. I'm talking to author Tilar J. Mazzeo about her book, Irena's Children, A True Story of Courage. You write in the book that in 1941, acts of impulsive courage still felt energizing and electric to Irena, but personal danger still seemed remote and abstract. So I'm curious, when did the tide turn and personal danger become more real to Irena?
I think that really changed in the summer of 1942, which was when the deportations to the death camps intensified. So up until that point, they'd been smuggling out a pretty small number of children, right? So in the beginning, it's orphaned children. Ultimately, as the conditions worsen, she reaches out to people that she knows in the ghetto and in the Jewish community and offers to help save their children.
Mm-hmm.
But at that point, it's really a pretty small number of children that they're smuggling out, and it's a relatively closed circle. But when the massive deportations start, you know, tens of thousands of people a day, at that moment, she really mobilizes her network, and they decide that they have to start getting out as many children as they possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they're getting them out at a time where the presence of death is extremely present for them. So, you know, for me, one of the most moving parts of Irena's story is there's a moment early on where a group of street children are rounded up on what was called the Aryan side the Polish side of Warsaw. They round up children who are Jewish, the street children. The Germans basically, you know, say, there's Jewish children, we're going to execute them, because mm-hmm. being outside the ghetto was a capital crime. And so Irena and another one of her colleagues, they smuggle those children back into the ghetto at the orphanage of a man named Janusz Korczak. And she really thinks of those children in some ways as her children, right? I mean, she saved them. She smuggles dolls across the border into the ghetto for them. She goes to their plays in the orphanage. I mean, she really is bonded with these children.
Yeah.
And there's one day where those children are marched to Treblinka and ultimately to their death. And she stands there on the street corner and watches the children and Janusz Korczak walk past her, knowing what it means. And I think after that, she says that she always understood that at that point, things were going to happen that were going to be very terrible and very violent. And I think at that point, she understood for the first time that probably in the end, she was probably going to end up on the radar screen of the Gestapo, which of course she does.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, in the end, she wound up saving, I believe it was 2,500 children. And I'm curious, you know, as time went on, the weight of all the lives she was bearing on her shoulders must have had some impact on her. How did she deal with the pressure?
Yeah, she said even she didn't die until quite late. She was 98 when she died in Warsaw. So she does survive the war and live to see many of those children go on to have children and even grandchildren. But she said that she was haunted by nightmares. Mm. So the nightmares for her never stopped. So, I mean, in some ways, I'm not sure that I think the way she handled it was by continuing to force herself to be courageous, right?
Okay.
But at the same time, she says that the moment that parents gave up their children to her, she mm-hmm. said that she was haunted by that her entire life, that the nightmares really for her started during the war, and they never ended. You know, she always felt that she should somehow have done more. There isn't more that she could possibly have done.
Yeah.
But I think she carried with her what she witnessed for the rest of her life.
Is that you think the reason why she's so strong in saying she's not a hero? Because you quote her in the book as saying she doesn't really like to be called that.
Yeah, no, she really resisted the idea that she was a hero. What she said was, you know, heroes do extraordinary things. I did what anybody would have and should have done,
yeah.
Which of course puts a lot of weight on all of us. I would like to believe I would have been half as courageous as Irena Semler. I think that's one of the reasons is that, 2,500 children, the estimate from the Jewish Holocaust Memorial in Israel, their estimates are that might have been as many as half of the children, Jewish children, who were saved from the ghetto that she and her group saved. So on the one hand, you know, they save this astonishingly large number, and yet there were so many children who died. And I think the other thing that she really wanted to signal was that she said that for every child she saved, 10 Polish people in Warsaw risked their lives.
Mm.
And she really wanted to honor that fact that when, after the war, she wrote a list of everybody who helped her, that list was 14 pages long.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I think it's great. I mean, the book is titled Irena's Children. I'm talking to the author, Tilar J. Mazzeo. But what you point out clearly in this book is that she is definitely not the only person involved in this. There is an entire network of people risking their lives and whose personalities and lives you flesh out in the book. So she gave that network of people a lot of credit throughout her life, did she?
She absolutely did. For her, that was incredibly important that she did not do it alone. That, because in some ways, right, for the Polish people, I mean, and I say that, you know, at one point, I think it's a kind of story about Poland as well, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that the Polish people did resist. I mean, not all Polish people resisted. And of course, there were Polish people who were undoubtedly, you know, clearly anti-Semitic throughout the German occupation. But the problem is that for the Poles, there was no way after the war, because after the war, the Stalinist period in Poland began, right? Mm-hmm. And you couldn't speak of acts of resistance because those acts of resistance were largely funded by American and British sources, right? Mm-hmm. So to have fought to save Jewish people after the war was seen as a mark of Western dissidence, corruption.
Yeah.
So the Poles couldn't really tell that story of the ways in which they had tried in many cases to resist and had tried as a community to organize and do things. And one of the reasons that I think the repression in Poland was as terrible as it was during the Second World War is because the resistance was really quite alive.
Yeah.
I mean, if we look at the list of people, again, that Yad Vashem has of what's known as the righteous Gentiles, or, you know, the people who tried to help the Jewish community during the Holocaust, there are more Polish names on that list than from any other country. So I think that's the other thing, is that she wanted to signal that we couldn't talk about this until the end of the Cold War. But as a people, there was a group of us as a people who tried very hard to do the right thing in the face of this.
Yeah. Well, even there's another story that really struck me in the book. It's about a group of 12 children and adolescents who decide amongst themselves who would get 3 available typhoid vaccine. And they made the decision logically and selflessly. And I'm thinking, you know, as you're talking about this spirit of resistance, you know, is that what we can attribute that selflessness to, even in these children and young people who are, you know, who are part of that story?
Yeah, that's an amazing story. I mean, this is a story of a group of children who made the decision, as you say, about who to give the vaccination to, so who wouldn't die. And the decision that the kids made amongst themselves is that they would give it to the boy who was supporting his younger sibling. And you think about what that means, that you have a 13, 14-year-old boy who's supporting his younger sibling within the face of this because his parents are gone.
Yeah.
And to the girl who, in their group, was doing the most to help other children. I mean, it was certainly a moment where some of the stories about the teenagers are the most inspiring stories about what young people were capable of doing in terms of ethical decision making and solidarity was absolutely astonishing.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to remember that some of the people who were helping to smuggle children out, because Irena herself smuggled children out, but she also had a group of couriers, because as the war goes on, you know, her network grows when she becomes funded by a resistance organization called Jagada.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that point, teenage girls are among her most important couriers. So teenage girls are often the ones who are leading the children out through things like the sewers that run underneath the city, or you know, helping them out in coffins underneath the bodies of the dead.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was just an impressive part of, you know, the story, because, you know, sometimes when you're surrounded by man's inhumanity to man, it can bring out the worst in people, but it seemed to bring out the best in a lot of people.
Absolutely at the heart of that story.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I'm talking to Tilar J. Mazzeo about her book, Irena's Children. Now, at the Christophers, all the work we do kind of reflects on this motto, it's better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. And I couldn't help but think of that when I was reading this book, Irena's Children. How do you think that, you know, the story you're telling in Irena's Children fits into that light in the darkness category?
I think that's, for me, the takeaway of this story, right, which was, it's a profoundly moving and inspiring story for me, although there are parts of it, of course, that as you, I mean, that are, there is a great darkness in the Holocaust,
sure.
Right? But there's that moment where I quoted at the end of the book where one of the children whose lives she saved says that, you know, Irina Semler was the brightest star in the dark night of the Holocaust, right? Mm-hmm. Which I think is that same idea that you're talking about of the candle in the darkness, right?
Yeah.
That in some ways, the darkness of the Holocaust was so intense that to know that there were these people who were, again, like we were talking about, they're not saints. They're average flawed people like us, mm-hmm. right? Who decided that they would respond to barbarity with decency. I think that's really the heart of that story. And for me, it's one of the really profound moments. If you ever have a chance to go to Warsaw and visit Irina Semler's grave, one of the lovely things is that she's buried in this lovely kind of copse in the forest. And of course, what everybody has done is people go and light candles on her grave. So mm-hmm. it's an amazing thing to see a way in which you go in the middle of an afternoon on an average day and see candles alight on her grave, and kind of a recognition of the exact idea that you're talking about.
I'm Tony Rossi. You're listening to Christopher Close-Up, and I've been talking to Tilar J. Mazzeo about her book, Irina's Children, A True Story of Courage. Irina Semler saved over 2,500 Jewish children during the Holocaust in Poland. And it's an amazing story, an inspiring story, but as Tilar points out in the book, she really fleshes out the humanity, the complex humanity of all the people involved in this. And it's an amazing story of heroism, even though Irina Semler didn't like that word. She did something extraordinary, and she calls on us, by her example, to do the extraordinary too, because all of us have the ability to be that extraordinary when faced in a tough situation. So again, read Tilar J. Mazzeo's book, Irina's Children. It's a powerful story. And Tilar, thanks for writing the book and talking about it on the show today.
Thanks very much. My pleasure to be with you today.
Now, before we end today's show, here's a message the Christophers would like to share with you.
When Father James Keller founded the Christophers, he chose the organization's name because it means Christ bearers in Greek. He wanted to encourage everyone to discover their God-given talents, combine their faith with action, and change the world for the better. For ideas on how you can be a Christ bearer in your own life, the Christophers have prepared a news note called Being a Christopher. It's filled with quotes and insights from Father Keller himself, who once explained, "The presence of even one Christopher in any environment is a blessing, a channel of grace, and a step in the right direction. It's like a tiny pinpoint of light that is greater than the encircling darkness." To request your free copy of Being a Christopher, send an email to radio@christophers.org or call our toll-free number at 1-888-298-4050. We look forward to hearing from you.
In closing, I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in today, and I encourage you to visit our website at christophers.org to learn more about the Christophers and to download free literature and podcasts. When you're there, you can also find links to our blog and our Facebook and Twitter pages. And if you have any questions or comments about the show, you can send an email to radio@christophers.org. Our engineer for today's show is Brian Bonifacio, and I'm Tony Rossi, your host. Thanks again for joining us, and remember that it's better to light one candle than to curse the darkness.